Okay, so yesterday I began to talk about parabolic subgroups. And I'll continue to discuss that for most of today. So we've had a connected reductive linear algebraic group, and we had a Borel subgroup. So it's maximal among the set of connected closed solvable subgroups, and we had T, a maximal torus in there, and the roots and a base for the roots. Okay, and now I want to discuss the parabolic subgroups containing B. So take a subset of the base, and you have an associated parabolic subgroup. Well, first of all, a subgroup of the Weyl group. Take the Weyl group generated by the reflections attached to the roots in your subset I. Subgroup of the Weyl group. Take those reflections as alpha 1s over I. And then we know from the Bruha decomposition that we can write G as BWB. Well, here I'm choosing representatives for in the normalizer of T for elements of W. And now our parabolic attached to I will just consist of certain double cosets. Piece of I is then the double cosets that have the property that the element of the normalizer actually has image in the subgroup of the Weyl group. Okay. So this is a parabolic subgroup. Obviously containing B. Okay, so I mean a parabolic subgroup is a subgroup that contains some Borel, and we're just looking at the ones that contain B because all of the parabolic, any parabolic is conjugate to one that contains B. So we can describe the structure of the piece of I in terms of root groups and certain reductive subgroups occurring as centralizers of Torii. And actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to call this such a piece of I, I'm going to call a standard parabolic subgroup. So the notion of standard parabolic is just convenient. It's convenient to work with the parabolics that contain a given Borel. So the notion of standard is always relative to some choice of Borel subgroup. The standard, you choose a Borel, and the standard parabolics are the ones that contain a standard parabolic subgroup. Okay. And any parabolic is conjugate to some standard one. Subgroup is conjugate to some piece of I. That just follows, I mentioned this before, it follows from the fact that a parabolic contains a Borel, and any two Borels are conjugate. So if you have a parabolic that contains a Borel, you can conjugate that Borel to B, and therefore you can conjugate that parabolic to a Borel containing B. Okay. So now, look at the following subset of the roots. You take the set of alphas that when expressed in terms of linear combinations of the simple roots being the ones in delta, the only ones that occur are the ones in I. Okay, the ones that occur with non-zero coefficient are the ones in I. So alpha is a linear, is an integral linear combination. Of roots, of simple roots in I. Maybe I should put that in parentheses. So I don't want to confuse you that everything in I is a simple root because it's contained in delta. Okay, so. All right. Now, this has just a root system. And it has vowel group. We have attached to any root system, we have an abstract vowel group, and not surprisingly, we're going to get the W sub I. That's the vowel group there. Now we can say, let's look at the roots. Well, P sub I is an algebraic group, contains the torus T because P sub I contains B and B contains T. What are the roots? When I defined roots, I didn't assume that my original group was reductive, although most of the time I do take a reductive group there. Well, if we look at the roots there, then we'll just get the positive roots, and we'll get some other roots coming from V sub I. Okay. So when I looked at my roots of my Borel, remember that the unipotent radical of the Borel is generated by all the U alphas, I just got C plus. The unipotent radical of the Borel is generated by the U alphas for alpha and C plus. And what I'm getting now is I'm throwing in a few extra roots sitting in phi sub I. Of course, I actually have all of phi sub I in this set, obviously, because some of the phi sub I's that are not in here are in here. Okay? All right, now let's take the unipotent radical of this group, phi sub I. It's going to be generated by some of the U alphas. Well, some of the U alphas for alpha positive, but not all of the positive ones. So it'll be generated by those root groups contained in it. And the root groups that are contained in it are the positive roots that are not in this set phi sub I. Okay, so they are associated to the positive roots that are contained in I. So it turns out to be those U alpha with alpha, of course that's root positive, but not in the set phi sub I. Okay, and now I want to, this just tells me something about the unipotent radical of the parabolic. I really want to describe the whole parabolic. So to do that, I need to look at a certain reductive subgroup, which I'm going to produce as a centralizer of a torus. So attached to I, I'm going to have a torus contained in T, which will just be the intersection. So let's pick the intersection of the alphas in phi sub I of the kernels of those roots, and then of course we want a connected group, so we'll take the identity component of that intersection. Okay. So it's just some torus sitting inside T, and then I want to look at the centralizer. Let's call it M sub I. The centralizer of this subtorus in G. Okay. All right. Now, this is a reductive group. Well, we know that the centralizer of a torus is reductive. And it's generated by T and the U alphas with the U alpha, those U alphas with alpha in the subset C sub I. Okay, so you could start here. You could start with I and said, well, let's just produce this T sub I and produce this reductive group. And then look at what happens, and then throw in the unipotent radical later. And what else can I say about this? T sub I is the identity component of the center. Of course, P sub I is in the center of M sub I, since M sub I is the centralizer. So, i.e., it's the radical of M sub I. In a reductive group, the radical is the identity component of the center. Okay. So now we have this reductive group, and we can ask, one, it also contains T, of course, since T certainly centralizes any subtorus. So your roots, what would the roots be? So let's take the roots of M sub I relative to the torus T, and you will get C sub I. Some other information, the Lie algebra of M sub I is, take Ti, this will be the Lie algebra of the torus. Well, this is just the standard decomposition. If I know that the roots are phi sub I, then I know I have to have the following decomposition of the Lie algebra. The torus plus the various root spaces for T in the Lie algebra of M sub I. And we know those are the ones that correspond to the roots in V sub I. Okay, so this is the Lie algebra of Ti. And then direct. Yes, all of T, sorry, the algebra of T. Okay, and now M sub I actually normalizes M sub I, and even more, we have a direct product, a semi-direct product. So M sub I and M sub I do not intersect. So we have a semi-direct product like this, corresponding to the corresponding semi-direct product, if we had just had B, would have just been the original torus semi-direct product, the full unipotent radical of B, which is what we were calling U before. U was the notation I used for the unipotent radical of B. Okay, so what you're doing is just throwing in some extra root spaces beyond what you would have had when you just looked at B. Okay, but you're doing it in sort of a consistent way. I mean, you want to take, you have to fix your particular subset of I, and then see like this. Okay, so M supply is what we call a levy factor. Or sometimes a levy component is the terminology used. Or sometimes people say a levy subgroup of PI. Okay, so parabolic subgroups have this kind of a structure where they are semi-direct products of a reductive group that is produced as a centralizer of a subtorus of the torus you're working with, and a unipotent group, which is the unipotent radical of the parabolic. Okay. Now, levy factors are not unique, so this is why I'm saying a levy factor, because it is possible to express a parabolic as a semi-direct product in different ways. So, more generally, a reductive subgroup M of P sub I is a levy factor of P sub I if you still have this semi-direct product decomposition like that. Okay. Now, you could, in fact, what you will have is a conjugate of M sub I by some element and in the unipotent radical. So little n would be in the unipotent radical of the parabolic sum. So in a, and we would call this a levy decomposition of the parabolic P sub I. When I'm working with the factor M sub I might actually say that it is, I would call this a standard levy factor. Because of the way that I produced it, centralizing that subtorus corresponding to the set I. Okay? So the unipotent radical, actually, M sub I itself is independent of I. It's just a unipotent radical. So it's worth mentioning that M sub I is just a unipotent radical of P sub I. And if I hadn't produced, if I just had it as P, I mean, of course, the P depends on the I, but unipotent radicals are unique. So once you have the parabolic, your unipotent radical is whatever it is, but your levy factor could vary. Okay. Another thing that's kind of interesting, you can also say that two of these subgroups are, if we have two standard parabolics, P sub I and P sub J, something I said last time. Suppose we had two standard parabolics corresponding to subsets I and J, then P sub I can only be conjugate to P sub J if P sub I is equal to P sub J. Okay. But it is possible to have the levy, the standard levy factors that I produced here being conjugate to, this is the levy factor for P sub I, the standard levy factor for P sub I could be conjugate to the standard levy factor for P sub J when I is not equal. And here in that case, of course, you have I equals J. When I is not equal to J, and so P sub I is not equal to P sub J. This can happen because, for example, you can, if if it is possible to produce J as the image of I under some Weyl group element, then you can convince yourself that the Levy subgroups are actually conjugate, because you're looking, if you think about how you produce the M sub I, the central letters as the T sub I. Okay, so you're really conjugating T sub I to T sub J, and so therefore you're conjugating M sub I to M sub J. Okay, so the Levies can be conjugate. Okay, now if, I'll just say if P is a parabolic subgroup, it has also got a Levy decomposition in sort of the obvious way. It may not be standard, but it's conjugate to a standard one, and you can just conjugate a Levy decomposition for the standard one to a Levy decomposition. Has Levy decomposition. Which you can obtain in the obvious way by conjugation, so you'll have something like this. And then the radical, uniform radical of P, and this is some reductor occurring, and again, you could write it as conjugate to something as a centralizer of a torus, take a maximal torus in here, and so on. Okay, so you obviously have this for general parabolic. And now, the last remark I want to make about the parabolics and the absolute case that is over the algebraically closed field is that if you have a proper parabolic, subgroup, then the semi-simple rank, the rank of this parabolic of the Levy component of, I want to talk about the rank of the Levy factor, so the semi-simple rank of a Levy factor, it doesn't matter which one because they're all conjugate, right? So they all have the same semi-simple rank, is actually less than the semi-simple rank of G. The rank is the same because it contains some maximal torus, and the rank of the Levy factor is then the maximal torus, but it's also maximal, the dimension of the maximal torus, but of course that's also a maximal torus in G, so the rank is actually the same as the rank of G. But the semi-simple rank is smaller. When you take semi-simple rank, what you're taking is the rank of M sub I modulo, that's stood in the standard case. You're taking the rank of M sub I modulo its radical. What is its radical? It's this here. So you're really taking the rank of the group that you get when you mod M sub I by this torus. So when you think about maximal tori in that quotient, T mod Ti, for example, is, and Ti has positive dimension in the case where P is proper. So you are getting a smaller semi-simple rank. This is very useful for inductive arguments. So this fact is often used in inductive arguments. Look at some examples. Okay, so this I had put up yesterday, indicating the roots. Character group and the one parameter subgroups and writing down the roots for GLN. Writing down a base. The base I chose was corresponding to the roots where the root spaces are with entries just right above the diagonal. So that base would correspond to a Borel, because each base of the root system corresponds to one Borel. You take the T, and then you take the U to be the subgroup generated by the U alphas for the positive roots. Well, in this case, the positive root spaces are all lying above the diagonal. So what are you doing? You're taking upper triangular matrices in GLN. So attached to this base, the Borel is just upper triangular matrices. Of course, if I change the basis, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to flip some of those root spaces below the diagonal, and I'll get some above and some below, or else all below, depending on how I change the base. So now, I want a standard parabolic containing this Borel. So I'm going to take a subset of delta, quad I, and then I look at the T sub I, which comes from the kernel of the intersection, the connecting component of the kernels of the roots inside that set that I chose. So, okay, so I have a root. Let's say it's, you know, corresponding to EI minus EJ. And the kernel, then, well, you have to have the ith place on the torus equal to the jth place on the torus. Okay. And of course, then you're going to have a bunch of roots that you're doing this with. So you're going to have a subtorus consisting of where I've got to put certain entries equal. Okay. So the torus is going to look like this. You're going to have something here repeated however many times, maybe only once, depending on whether or not what roots are in the set I, and then you're going to have some other repetitions here and so on. Okay. So when you look at what commutes with that, well, you can just see in terms of blocks what that looks like. So if you look at the centralizer of that torus I just wrote down, then you get a bunch of copies of GLN on the sort of sitting on the diagonal correspond. N1 is the number of A1s, N2 is the number of A2s, and so on. And then the unipotent radical, I have to take the positive roots, but not the roots that are in the set phi sub I. So if you think about the roots that are, let me write this on the board, coming from the set phi sub I, and their root spaces are the ones that are getting you into the M sub I. So the positive roots here, this is N1, are not going to be contributing to the unipotent radical at all. And then this is N sub 2 by N sub 2, and the positive roots here are not contributing. Those root spaces actually correspond to something in the M sub I. And so do these ones, but they're not positive roots involved, so I don't ignore those. So I take all the other positive root spaces, which means all the entries of like this. Okay, when I'm generating my unipotent radical, and then of course I do not have anything there anymore because I'm looking at the root spaces. I just have ones in the diagonal and then zeros. Okay, so for the particular kind of I that I chose here, you're going to get this kind of a Levy subgroup. Okay, for a particular base and I. All right. And of course, then you can conjugate any parabolic into something that looks like this. Okay, and then you can change the order that you choose things if you want in your set I, but you'll always get something that is actually isomorphic to. So the M sub I looks like this. Up to conjugacy. Okay, so I haven't written everything out there, but I've written enough to tell you what you would get if you did all the other possibilities as well. Okay, so now let's look at SP4. And this is what I had before with the realization of the group, the algebra, the torus was the diagonal matrices in G, and I had written down particular characters, chi 1 minus 1 and chi 0 2. Okay, well, I'm identifying my characters like this. Okay, so chi 1 minus 1 takes this matrix to A big inverse, and chi 0 2 takes it to B squared. And then I get these other characters in the root space, in the roots that I had a base that, well, for a base, I'm going to choose the same base I wrote down last time, which is just alpha and beta. So this is a small example. There aren't going to be that many standard parabolic subgroups, right? Because the group has such small rank. So here are the root spaces and the various elements of the, well, the Val group is generated by the S alpha and the S beta. So now when you take your standard parabolics, what are your subgroups, subsets of delta? Well, you could take all of delta, or you could take the empty set, or you could take alpha, or you could take beta. Right? So two of those are just going to give you B and G, and then the other two are going to give you some proper parabolics. Okay. So what do those look like? Well, okay, the Borel that you would get here also corresponds to the subgroup of upper triangular matrices. If you look at the roots, I only wrote down the root space for G minus alpha. I did not write down the root space for G minus beta or G minus alpha plus beta or G minus 2 alpha plus beta, but you will get lower triangular matrices if you look at the root spaces for minus alpha, minus beta, minus alpha, minus beta, and minus 2 alpha, minus beta. And obviously from what I've written here, you get upper triangular matrices when you look at the root spaces for the positive roots. So the Borel is coming from the torus, and the unipotent radical is generated by, so the torus and the unipotent radical give you the Borel, and the unipotent radical is generated by the root groups for the positive roots. And you'll get all upper triangular matrices in G, because you're getting every possible upper triangular matrix coming from the positive root space. Okay, so the Borel is actually the upper triangular matrices. Okay, and then G is just G. So apart from G and B, we have two standard parabolic subgroups, which I'm just going to call P alpha and P beta, attached to the subsets alpha and beta, respectively. And what is T alpha? You look at the kernel of alpha, well, the identity component, which, in fact, in this case is the same. But then A has to equal B. So then you, let's produce the M alpha. So M alpha has to be the centralizer of that torus. Okay, in G. So, but the centralizer of that torus in GL4 is obviously just GL2 cross GL2. But then, of course, you've got to look at that intersected with the symplectic group, but luckily it's only a 4x4 symplectic group, and you can decide pretty quickly that you get this kind of a description for the group. You get if you can write it this way, you have a block and matrix 2x2 that's in GL2K, and then the other block has to be related to the first one in the following way because of the condition for being in the symplectic group. So you actually get a Levy component here that is isomorphic to a GL2. And then for the unipotent radical, you're always filling in the root groups for the roots that don't fit in your, they're not sitting in the, that are not roots for the M alpha. Okay? And if you just look at M alpha, then you can see the root spaces that are not occurring there. And you just are going to get anything here, any of the root spaces corresponding to matrices like this. Okay. And that B means the B transpose is again because you're actually in SP. Okay. And the other one, well, the T beta, B has to be 1. Okay. And the centralizer of T beta. Well, if you just looked at it in GL4, you would get a GL1 and a GL2 block in the middle, and then a GL1 down below on the diagonal way. And then, so that's sort of like, well, anyway, so then I intersect that with SP4, of course. I'm looking at the centralizer in SP4, not the centralizer in GL2. And I get the following conditions if I just write out what the conditions on the matrix would be. So this inner block, which wasn't GL2, now has to have determinant 1, and then this GL1 has to be the inverse of that one, the entry has to be. So you get two copies, one copy of GL1, or the multiplicative group, or K-cross, whatever you want to call it, and one copy of SL2K, which is just the matrices in GL2 with determinant 1. Okay? And so your Levy, as an algebraic group, your Levy factor here is isomorphic to SL2K cross K cross. And then if you look at the root spaces for the positive roots and you look at the corresponding root groups, well, you would have the one root group with the 1, 1, x, 1, minus x, 1, and then the root group with the 1s here, 0s there, and the 2y's there, and then the root group with x and y, 0, and z, whatever you want, and all 1's there. And those are the ones that correspond to the positive roots that do not have root spaces sitting inside the drop this U alpha. Okay, so this should show you that it's the whole idea of producing parabolics. You can just do it systematically. It's quite straightforward. When you do this kind of thing, you obviously get various kind of Levy. When you look at your Levy components, they're going to look, they involve certain reductive groups, but they don't necessarily involve the same kind of group that you started with. For GL, they do, but I mean, GL is a very special case. I started with a symplectic group, and then I got a general linear group for one of the Levies, and here I got an SL2, which actually is a symplectic group. It's the 2x2 symplectic group, if you think about it, and then another GL1. So you get various groups occurring inside your Levy factors. Okay, this only gets complicated if you actually try to do this for groups of large rank and you actually try to write it out explicitly. All right, so now I have to do the relative theory. So I haven't said anything about what happens for parabolic subgroups when I'm working over a proper subfield of my ambient algebraically closed field. So let me describe how that works. Okay, now that, in some ways, looks very much like what I just did. Before I define the parabolic subgroups, let me mention a little bit of terminology. So now I'm going to work in what we call the relative theory, where you have a subfield. Okay, and I'm going to, at the end, put up a list of references, which will tell you where to look for some of this theory. Okay, so then now we're going to take, again, I'm putting connected in parentheses because I did define reductive only in the connected case. Reductive. I'm going to assume I have a K group. That is, this linear algebraic group is defined over K. Okay. What can you say? Well, first of all, G has a maximal torus, which is defined over K. Now, the examples I did, because they're what we call split groups, those examples don't actually illustrate what I'm doing today in complete generality. But in any case, if you have a G and you just randomly choose a maximal torus, it will not be defined over the field, the base field, the smaller field. But there will be some torus which is defined over the smaller field. Okay. Now, if you're lucky, that you'll be able to do it, you'll be able to find one that is actually K-split. So we say that G is K-split if G has a maximal torus, which is K-split. Okay, so in that case, you look at your rational points, you really do get something that's isomorphic to little k cross, cross, little k cross, 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 little k cross, the right number of times. Okay, so when you look at your rational points, it still looks kind of like what it looks like over the algebraically closed field, but you only replace the algebraically closed field by the base field. Okay? Okay, which is... Yep, sorry. Little k. Yes, thank you. Yes, it's... Yes, it has tori that are defined over capital K, too, all of them are, but that's irrelevant. Okay, so now, the groups that I was working with were split. GLN is a split group, yeah, you can see over any subfield that you, diagonal matrices is still a split torus, and SP is also a split group, that diagonal subgroup in SP is also obviously going to be a split torus, okay? So that's why I say that what I did in those examples is not illustrate the general setup. It illustrates the setup for split groups. Okay, so, but not every torus will necessarily split. You have situations where some tori split and some don't. And the tori that I wrote down a torus in GL2C, which was R anisotropic. I wrote down a R torus in GL2C, which is R anisotropic. Well, there are obviously split tori in GL2C as well. They split over, so some will split over R and some won't. So if you have a split group, it just says some torus will split over the field, but not necessarily all. Generally, almost never all. Okay, so in this situation, you'll see from what I'm about to say, parabolics, all the parabolics are defined over K, and you construct them exactly as I just did. Yeah, okay? In the general situation, it's slightly different. Okay. The opposite extreme of split is anisotropic, well, K-anisotropic. Okay. If it doesn't contain any K-split tori. Yes. Okay, so in this case, what I'm about to do gives me no information. Well, the reason for that is that there's not very many parabolic subgroups in that case. You'll see in a second. Okay. Well, one thing that's also worth mentioning before I talk about the parabolics is if you have a non-split group, it will split over a finite separable extension. So that's kind of something that's useful. If G is not K-split, or even if it is, then the separable extension is trivial. So G will split over some finite separable extension. Well, that's just because the tori split over finite separable extensions. So if you're willing to work in a slightly larger field, then you can assume the group is split. Okay, now, if G is K-split, this leads into the construction of the parabolic. Thinking about how we constructed them, we just took centralizers of subtori of a particular torus, and we also took unipotent radicals generated by these various root groups. If we want to do the same thing here with K groups, then we want those root groups to be defined over K. And they are. So it works. Okay, so if G is K split, and if we take T to be a split torus, is a K split maximal torus in G, then, and you don't want to choose your T randomly, you want to make sure it is K split, because if you choose a non K split torus, then this statement is false. Then each root group alpha in the root of T relative to G is defined over K. And the associative isomorphism epsilon alpha, which goes from the isomorphism from the additive group to the U alphas, which actually, incidentally, in the examples that I did, you can see what a natural isomorphism would be in those cases, can be chosen so that it's defined over K. Okay. Can be taken to be defined over my little K. Well, whenever I say defined over K, I mean little K, because everything inside is defined over capital K. Okay. Now, and another remark I'll just make before I talk about the parabolic, if you have, suppose you have G and G prime are connected reductive K groups, which are isomorphic. Connected reductive K split K groups, which are isomorphic, then isomorphic over little K as well. So G and G prime are K isomorphic. You need K split for this. Okay, so I'm just saying I have these connected reactive K groups. They happen to be split over K, and they also happen to be isomorphic. So that means there's an isomorphism of algebraic groups from G to G prime. Saying that they're K isomorphic means there's an isomorphism of algebraic groups from G to G prime, and that isomorphism is defined over the little field K. Is that something not clear? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I forgot to say that. Yeah. And are isomorphic. Yeah, I said it, but I didn't write it. Thanks. Yeah. Say that again? Essentially, yeah. Because everything does work over K then, yeah, right. But in general, it's not true. So if you have two K split groups and they are isomorphic as algebraic groups, they are not necessarily isomorphic it's not necessarily an isomorphism defined over the subfield. And in that case, we use the terminology forms. You'd say G prime is a form of G if it's isomorphic to G, but it might not be isomorphic over, because if the groups aren't split, it won't necessarily be isomorphic over subfields. Okay. We won't actually need to use that, but it's worth noting. Okay, so now I have to do this rather quickly. There are several things that you can say about centralizers of Torii. The centralizer of a K-torus, so a K-torus is a torus in G, which is defined over K, in G, is, well, we already know it's reductive, but the extra information that it is defined over K. If T happens to be K-split, which it may not be, it may just be defined over K, but if it is K-split, then the centralizer is a Levy factor of some parabolic. Of some, and we would say a K-Levy factor, because it's defined over K, of some parabolic K subgroup. And I didn't define K subgroup before, but the meaning is obvious. It's a subgroup that is defined over K. Okay. But if it's not K split, then it's not, I mean, it's a Levy factor of a parabolic if you're just looking over capital K, but that parabolic may not be defined over little k, and also the Levy factor may not be defined over little k. And even if the Levy factor is defined over little k, the parabolic still might not be. So if you're looking at centralizers of non-split tori, then you don't have as nice a situation as you have in the split case. So I cannot just choose a maximal torus and go ahead and do what I just did, because then when I look at the corresponding T sub I, those would not be K-split necessarily, and so then the process breaks down. Okay. So what is the next best thing? The next best thing is to look for a torus which is K-split, but which is might not be maximal, because there may not be any maximal tori that are K-split. So the idea is the following, is to use maximal K-split tori. So I'm just going to roughly describe this. It'll be in more detail in the notes. Let it be a S be a maximal K-split torus in G. Okay, so it's not a maximal torus. It's maximal among the set of K-split tori. Okay. Now, what I stopped assuming G was split. I actually haven't made any assumptions about G. I said if G is split there, and then this is one statement which is just sitting by itself. Okay, so G is a connected reductive K group. No. Okay? All right, so take a maximal K split torus. One thing that you need to know is that any two of these are conjugate. Okay. Under the rational point. So the set of such S is any two such S. Any two such S are conjugate, such S's, S and S prime, what the heck, S prime are conjugate by an element not just of G, but an element of the rational point. Okay. Okay. K rank of G is now defined. Find that to be the dimension of S. Since any two such S are conjugate, that makes sense now. Semi-simple K rank G, that would be the K rank of G mod its radical. unipotent radical. No, it's radical. It doesn't have a unipotent radical. So, might out by the identity component of the center. And look at the K rank of that group. Okay. So, very quickly, say a little bit about how I get parabolic subgroups. Another definition, just G is K quasi-split, or quasi-split over K, if there exists a Borel subgroup of G defined over K. In general, there does not exist a Borel that's defined over K. P, a parabolic K subgroup, its unipotent radical is automatically a K group defined over K. Okay, we can talk about a Levy K factor of a parabolic. It's just like before, if we have a K parabolic K subgroup, and we can write it as a semi-direct product of a reductive K group M and the unipotent radical, then that reductive K group is what we call a Levy K factor. So I'm not going to write everything down now. If you have a P, then if you look at the Levy K factors of P, any two are conjugate by something in the K rational points of the unipotent radical. If you have two parabolic subgroups and they are K groups and they are conjugate by something in the K rational points. So a lot of times you want to be knowing not just that things are conjugate, but they're actually conjugate by something in the K rational points. And G contains a proper parabolic subgroup, parabolic K subgroup, if and only if G contains a non-central K split torus, i.e. the semi-simple rank, simple K rank is positive. Okay, because our Levy factors of our parabolics are going to still be centralizers of tori, but they're going to be centralizers of K split tori. Okay. All right. So very quickly, how do I explain how this is done? Take an S that you have over there. It's a maximal K split tori. And then look at the K roots. What is that? Well, first of all, you just take the roots, and then you look at them, and you say, which of these are defined over K? And the ones that are defined over K are the K roots. You still get a root system. Okay? Root. Alpha in the roots here. Alpha defined over K. Shit, that root system has a base. Maybe more than one. Like a base. Take a subset of this. Now, follow the procedure. I don't have any time for this now. Follow the procedure I just did in the absolute case. Only you're just restricting to a subset of this. You can still define your T sub I, and it will be defined over K, and it will be K split. And you look at the centralizer, and you get a reductive subgroup that's defined over K. And then you want to get a parabolic, and you have to throw in certain roots And then it gets a little complicated because not all the attached to a root, what the problem, extra complication that might occur here is this is not necessarily a reduced root system. So this is not necessarily reduced. S is split. What will every root be defined over K? Yeah, actually it will, because S is split. Sorry, S is split. Right, because if I just choose them, it doesn't. So it doesn't matter. So this is automatic. Sorry. Right. If I just randomly choose a torus, then I have to be more careful. So only some of the roots are defined over K. Okay. So take this set of roots and follow the procedure that I described before, except you have to be a little careful if you don't have something that's reduced. So there's still going to be a subgroup, U alpha, attached to alpha, but now U alpha might not have Lie algebra G alpha because the root space G alpha might not be a subalgebra. If 2 alpha is a root, then G alpha is not generally a subalgebra. You have to take G alpha plus G2 alpha. And then you take there's a connected F stable subgroup that has that as its Lie algebra. So there's sort of a slightly different thing happening with the subgroups that are attached to the roots. But other than that, you follow what is almost the same kind of procedure that I just described. You have the centralizer of this torus, and then you take the Levy, the unipotent radical to be generated by certain of the U alphas, that you want the positive roots that don't occur in the subset, what we would call K phi I now, instead of phi I. And it's very much parallel to what is going on when you work with the general situation over the algebraically closed field, except now you possibly have fewer roots and fewer parabolics. This will give you parabolics defined over K, which we call standard parabolics. It's not a maximal torus. No. After what? Oh, they'll still be parabolics, but they'll be just the ones that are defined over K, right? So what we're really doing here is we're replacing. So we're not saying parabolic contained. So what we're going to get here is when we do this procedure, we will get some parabolic K subgroups. And they all contain a fixed minimal parabolic K subgroup. Minimal parabolic K subgroup. Minimal parabolic K subgroup exists because G is a parabolic K subgroup, right? And so in place of a Borel, you have minimal parabolic K subgroups playing a role here. And those, yes, they are. That's what I'm going to say next. The key fact here is that these minimal parabolic K subgroups are all conjugate. So these are all conjugate. These are all conjugate. Okay. Which means that they're conjugate under G. K, not just under G, because any two parabolics that are conjugate, any two K parabolics that are conjugate, they will be conjugate under the rational points. Okay, so that gives you a rough idea. And you also have an associated Bruhi decomposition for the K rational points. I'm just going to take one or two more minutes, not really not much, to mention that there's a Bruhi decomposition. Which is just saying, take the K rational points, this joint union, and let's take our, let's call this P0. Take our K rational points P0. P0, or W, P0. And what's this ranging over? Well, there's a vowel group of that root system, and one thing I didn't mention is that if you take the normalizer in G of S, you can write it as the rational points times the centralizer, which means that there is a k-rational representative for every element of the vowel group. This vowel group, the vowel group of that root system. And so then this actually makes sense. Here, W ranges over a set of k-rational representatives for the elements of the k-vowel group. Okay, so it looks very similar. You're just putting in the minimal parabolic instead of the Borel, which might be a Borel if the group is quasi-split. Okay, and then you have Levy. No, I mean as a set. If I take something here, I can find something in here, times something in there, that will equal it. Okay. And then the other thing to mention is that Levy decompositions and so on carry over to the k-rational points. Carry over to the k-rational points. In the sense that if M is a K Levy factor, you don't want to choose a Levy factor randomly, you want to choose a Levy factor that's defined over K. The unipotent radical always is defined over K. Then you take your K rational points and you get a semi-direct product like that. What did I use for unipotent radical? So a lot of times you're actually working with the k-rational points of the group, and you're working with, you know, k-rational points of parabolics, and it's useful to know that the Levy decompositions do carry over to the k-rational points. This general theory is not that all that different from what happens in the absolute case. You just are working with your minimal parabolics instead, and it's a slightly different root system for a possibly non-maximal torus. It doesn't give you all the information about the structure of the group because your minimal parabolic, what does it look like? It's not a torus in general. It's not a Borel, so it's not a semi-direct product of a torus and a unipotent group. So you get no information about this kind of structure of the group. You know, part of it is sort of hidden. It's not seen by the parabolic subgroup structure. Okay, so let me just put up the references to finish. Okay, so we have these three books I mentioned before, Linear Algebraic Groups. The second edition contains much more. You probably can't get the first edition anyway. Then for the relative theory, Borel tips is the standard reference. But you also will see some in the second edition of Borel. Some of it is explained there. These are just survey articles. This is to do with classification when you have perfect, semi-simple algebraic groups, when you have over perfect fields. And so there's some information there about, you know, what the parabolics look like and so on. And more information about root systems, you know, explicit information, which I haven't given. Bourbaki has a lot of information about root systems and so various things. And depending on what kind of field you work over, if you work over the reals, then the fact that your algebraic group is really a Lie, that real points of the group or a Lie group will come, the properties of Lie groups come in. If you work over non-Archimedean local fields, then the fact that you have a topological group with a topology coming from the local non-Archimedean field will come into the structure as well, not just the algebraic group fact. And so if you're working with local non-Archimedean fields, these are articles you can look at. And then you also want to look over the Adels, then you have something else going on there, and that structure also is important, so you can maybe look at this reference. This is a very short list of references, and it's by no means intended to be complete. I mean, there's a huge literature on algebraic groups and reductive algebraic groups in particular, which it's better not to let yourself get intimidated by. You start with the basics and then learn what you need to learn to do, solve the problems you need to solve. You don't have to be an expert in every aspect of linear algebraic groups in order to work in harmonic analysis and automorphic forms. You just have to know, you have to be an expert in certain things, not everything. Okay, that's it.